The debate over the minimum wage in this country. Is it time for an increase? That conversation is just ahead. And good Monday morning live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. And keep listening because just ahead, as Mayor Brown jumps into the fray over whether to increase the minimum wage, we want to know where you stand. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a preview of Dining Out for Life on the First Coast, helping this series' Northeast Florida AIDS Network, plus Culpepper on the NFL Draft and the Jaguars' prospects. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it wasn't your typical campaign message. Last week, Mayor Alvin Brown joined a local restaurant owner to say he supports an increase in the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Brown says he'll work with state lawmakers to get an increase to the state's minimum wage, which is currently at $8.05 an hour. But bills to raise the wage have gone nowhere so far in Tallahassee. This even though some Florida cities have raised the minimum wage for people working in city government. And at the national level, there's a push to bump up rates to keep pace with today's cost of living. Companies like Target and Walmart recently have raised their employees' minimum wages to $9 an hour. President Obama urged Congress to raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour during his 2014 State of the Union address. But others say a minimum wage is a tricky issue, that it's high enough as it is, and that raising it can actually increase unemployment. This morning, we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at the debate. On the line from Washington, Brian Mahoney joins us. He's the labor reporter for Politico. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also on the line, Eric Altieri. He's the director of communications with the Agenda Project, AP Action Fund. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me on this morning.
And we're already getting your calls. Give us a call right now and let us know, where do you stand on the push to raise the minimum wage in this country? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on Facebook. Brian, let's begin with you. Mayor Alvin Brown here in Jacksonville denied last week that he was electioneering close to a runoff election when he came out in favor of raising the minimum wage. It is a fact, though, that this is an issue that tends to pull better with Democrats than Republicans. Democrats in Congress are pushing on this issue. Where do things stand on Capitol Hill when it comes to this issue?
Well, right now, things may be heating up. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington State, is expected to announce as soon as this week a bill that would propose raising the federal minimum wage to $12 an hour. Now, in a Republican Congress, that's going to go nowhere. But across the aisle, we also have Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, who's suggesting a more modest increase of $9 an hour. So I think things may be heating up in the next few weeks or months, and certainly as we get into the presidential election, the idea of raising wages, I think we'll be hearing about more and more.
Eric Altieri, some Florida cities have already raised the wage just for city workers. Other West Coast cities like Seattle and San Francisco have moved ahead on this. Critics say, though, that raising the wage in those cities has actually increased unemployment. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think those critics largely don't have much facts on their side. If you really do look at places that have raised the minimum wage around the country, at worst, you have not seen an increase in employment, but we have never seen this really big backlash of people firing workers over a minimum wage increase. Just quite frankly, hasn't happened. Companies are making more money now than they have in the past decade, and it's time that they share that wealth with the workers that make that revenue possible for them.
Brian, you mentioned 2016. Hillary Clinton seems to be making income inequality and raising wage floors a signature issue of her just beginning presidential campaign. How do you see the Republican candidates responding and sticking out their position on this?
I think Republicans might be in a difficult spot here because a lot of their base also agrees with at least some modest increase in the minimum wage. If you look back at the 2014 elections, we saw minimum wage increases in four Republican states, Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Alaska. So while many Republicans might make an argument against the minimum wage, a lot of their voters actually support at least a modest increase. So I think you're going to see some favorable positioning from the right as well, and I think it might be politically necessary.
Is it so then, Eric Altieri, is it how long have we gone in this country without a minimum wage increase, and is it time?
I mean, it's been years since we've seen the federal minimum wage increase, and it's well overdue. And as you've been rightfully pointing out, not only is this really good policy, it is good politics. 63% of Americans in a recent poll favor a minimum wage increase of up to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. And 75% support that $12.50 level, including 53% of Republicans. So I do think the presidential contenders on both sides of the tickets here are going to have to get behind this. There's a growing social movement in support of this. People know that they really need and deserve a raise to help stimulate this economy. And what we're doing by not increasing these wages for working class Americans is effectively giving a tax subsidy to these corporations who pay their workers extremely low wages and then force that difference onto the public assistance programs. Places like Walmart and McDonald's, they pay their workers so low that we have to make up for it as taxpayers. And it's really time these corporations share the profits they're seeing at the top with their workers.
Brian, the fast food industry, Target, Walmart, they seem to be responding to that line of attack. Target and Walmart in particular have bumped up their minimum wage. How do you see that affecting?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think those raises are due to probably multiple factors. We see a tightening of the labor market in the lower end of the economy. But we also see, as mentioned, some serious labor activism happening, especially from workers and activists related to McDonald's and Walmart. And I think this ties into a larger national push on the part of unions like the AFL-CIO, which is a confederation of unions, that are really calling for a push for companies, even non-union companies, to raise their wages, while noting that, you know, over the past several years after the recession, wages haven't really risen, even as unemployment has dropped.
And lots of calls. We want to know where you stand on the push to raise America's minimum wage, for or against. 549-2937. Joe is in Callahan. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Talking about increasing the minimum wage, who's going to enforce that? Right now, the wage and hour division in Jacksonville is totally useless. And just recently, the Supreme Court even ruled in a decision where people were asking to be paid for the preparation time that they were coming in before and after work and preparing and staying after work and doing work without being paid at all. And Clarence Thomas wrote that if those people want to be paid for that, they need to bargain that with their employer. So, you know, if the federal government is not going to stand behind the minimum wage, why should we waste our time talking about it?
All right, and that's Joe in Callahan. Brian with Politico, go ahead.
The caller has a good point. Enforceability is a big question. Even on the federal level, we see a very active wage and hour division at the Labor Department, but very often they secure wages from employers for wage violations, and they can't find the workers to compensate them. So I think it's a great point that enforcement may be difficult, but I think a raise in the federal minimum wage, I think you would see a lot more compliance if it were enacted.
As you pointed out, though, that's a difficult issue to get through the Congress.
It is very difficult, especially now in a Republican Congress. They're not going to be friendly to a $12 an hour minimum wage. But again, as I mentioned, you have a Republican, Susan Collins, who's really been spending years trying to raise the minimum wage to at least $9 an hour. So she says she's nearing a bipartisan consensus there, so we'll have to wait and see.
And it's 549-2937. Sandy on the north side. Go ahead, Sandy.
Yes, I just wanted to say I agree with both of the commentators that it's long overdue for the minimum wage to at least to go to $10 an hour, and that the policymakers that sit over these decisions, you know, where they're coming from, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, sure, they're making millions of dollars or thousands of dollars, and they have great insurance, And I mean, we gotta help our fellow Americans out here on the minimum wage. I mean, it's overdue, and it needs to happen. And Alvin Brown needs to. I mean, there's nothing wrong with him to admit to that. I mean, that's where I'm coming from.
All right, that's Sandy on the north side. Eric Altieri, the mayor's opponent in our mayoral race, Lenny Curry, through his campaign spokesman, dismissed Alvin Brown's call for a push to increase the minimum wage as simply partisan electioneering, a last-minute stunt. This is an issue that tends to pull better with Democrats and Republicans. Alvin Brown, of course, is a Democrat. His opponent's a Republican. What about the partisan split on this issue?
I believe the partisan split really only exists in Washington. Amongst most Americans, the majority are behind raising the minimum wage. You know, what that level is, there's a bit of disagreement on, but we all know it needs to get above its current level. Meanwhile, we have the issue in Congress. I think the divide here is really between working class Americans and the wealthiest among us. While they're resisting raising the minimum wage a couple dollars an hour, they're trying to repeal the estate tax, which is going to cost our country over $200 billion in revenue over the next 10 years. I think it's better that we use that money and give workers a raise and help stimulate the economy by putting more money into everyday Americans' pockets.
And the lines are jammed as we get your calls on whether to increase America's minimum wage. Let's go to Andy in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Andy.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say I think that a $12 or $15 an hour minimum wage is kind of ridiculous. It might need to be increased a little bit, but it's an hourly wage. It's not salary. When you start moving into a $15 an hour range, you're getting into what most of the working force would consider a salary, not an hourly wage. How do you split it? What's the line? The over under. Flipping burgers, most hourly wage employees, if their pay is increased, that cost is going to be passed on to the consumer. And how does that, it benefits an individual, but overall, doesn't that create a slide instead of a gain?
And that's Andy downtown. Brian Mahoney, what about that argument?
Yeah, the caller identifies, I think, a question that we hear a lot when we talk about raising the minimum wage. And there are many studies that say prices might increase. There are many studies that say jobs may be lost. But there are other studies that say the opposite. So I think we're kind of in an experimental phase right now. If you look in Seattle and in San Francisco and in Oakland, California, we're seeing the wages rise. And I think it's right now too early to tell or to measure what effect those wage increases will have. But certainly it's a worry that many people are paying attention to.
Eric Altieri, let's talk about cities where there's been a laboratory on this front. Republicans will point to Seattle and San Francisco as proof that raising the minimum wage isn't effective. What's your counterargument?
I think that we don't have the information that they're claiming. It's not showing itself. They said that by raising the wage to $15 in Seattle would discourage businesses from opening up there. We've seen that's not the case. Applications for business licenses in the city have been pretty much steady, slightly growing, a little bit more above the national average in a lot of instances. We're not seeing a mass shutdown of businesses or layoffs of part-time or hourly workers. Simply, the sky has not fallen in any of these places where we've raised the wage. We're only seeing that it's actually benefiting workers who were already being left behind. If we raise the minimum wage even to just $10.50, that would only put us back in line with the real value of the minimum wage in the 1960s. We've not been keeping pace with productivity or median wages in this country when it comes to what we pay our working class citizens. And this is really just so overdue that we've been watching the wealth consolidate at the very top. It's time that the people who actually make these products and make this revenue for these corporations possible get a well-earned raise.
Mason is in Gainesville. Hey, Mason, thanks for calling in. All right, Mason, give us a call back. Elizabeth at the Beaches. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
My question is if there are any proposals in the works regarding sort of a when you think of specific huge companies that make lots of money, such as McDonald's, Walmart, if the increase in their minimum wage would be proportional to, say, their yearly profit.
Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth. Brian Mahoney of Politico.
I don't believe, or at least I don't know of any specific proposals that would do that, but activists calling for a raise in those companies' wages certainly point to the profits of those companies in arguing for doing so.
And we're getting feedback on social media as we get your calls, emails, and tweets about whether America should see a minimum wage increase. Here's a comment on Facebook. Yes, raise it. This would help working people. A tweet, though, says, big companies aside, no one wants to talk about how raising minimum wages affects small businesses with razor-thin margins. Eric Altieri, what about that tweet?
I'm sorry, what tweet?
Basically, someone's saying that raising the minimum wage could really impact a small business with a razor-thin profit margin.
Sure. I mean, that's obviously a big concern that a lot of people have when it comes to raising the minimum wage. I think that it also has to go along with, you know, we're not going to do this overnight. We're not going to flip a switch and get to a $15 an hour wage. No one's particularly advocating for that. We're talking about moving this up gradually and in a way that's intelligent. Certainly something like you just mentioned, where we do tie the impact to a company's revenue. So we can actually, you know, help transition these smaller businesses. We're not anti-business in any way. So we do want to make sure that what we're doing is business friendly and do this in a gradual way. And ultimately, it will benefit these businesses. When Americans have more money to spend, they put more money into the economy by buying these businesses' products. And really, the rising tide will ultimately lift all ships on this one.
Ryan tweets the show, I would argue salary wages also need to be increased. Wages across all levels need to increase. And we have Mason in Gainesville back on the air. Hi, Mason. Go ahead.
Hi. So I was curious why they don't. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead. Turn your radio down.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
That's okay.
I was curious why the federal government doesn't apply kind of a steady increase in the minimum wage, you know, because the, you know, inflation occurs very steadily. I figured that would give the markets time to catch up, apply their changes.
Yeah. Thanks, Mason, for that question. Brian Mahoney, why hasn't the wage kept pace with inflation?
I think legislating that would be very politically difficult. The caller is right. I think, you know, adjusted for inflation, our minimum wage was around $10 an hour in the late 60s, I believe. So certainly you might see more liberal minimum wage advocates calling for such a proposal because, as is evident right now, the current minimum wage is actually falling out of step with inflation.
Let's go to Patricia at the Beaches. Hi, Patricia.
Hey, good morning. I'm against increasing the wage. I think we need to, I think we're trying to increase the wage because we don't have any middle class jobs anymore. We have people that are flipping burgers that want $15 an hour, and that may be fine for the Northeast and the Northwest corridors where everything is a lot higher, but you take the Midwest and the South, I think that would hurt businesses, and I think we need to start encouraging our college kids instead of getting all these loans to go and get these minimum wage jobs to help put themselves through college because they would have less debt. And I think that's what those jobs are really for. Let's face it, it doesn't take a lot of skill to flip a burger. And you can't just say somebody should make $15 an hour. These people should not be trying to support themselves on that wage. But the one place I do think, and I never hear anyone say anything about it, is restaurant workers. Waiters and waitresses have this other pay scale where they can be paid very, very low and supposedly rely on tips. They should get minimum wage, and I don't know why they don't. I'm not in the restaurant business, but that's always been a thought of mine.
Thank
but
you.
I am against it, and Alvin Brown just lost my vote.
Thank you, Patricia. Eric Altieri, what about Patricia's call that too many people have lost middle class jobs are trying to get jobs in fast food restaurants and the like and that that our focus needs to be on creating better paying jobs, not increasing the minimum wage.
Well, I mean, by increasing the minimum wage, we are creating better paying jobs. And she references that this should be a job for someone to work their way through college. That used to be the case through the 60s and 70s when our real spending power of the minimum wage was closer to above $10. It became a lot more feasible for a person to work full-time at a minimum wage job and pay for their education. I used to be able to do that on just several hundred hours a year of work. You could cover the cost of an average public institution. That's no longer the case. Between rising college costs and the stagnation of wages, we can't do that anymore. And unfortunately, what we're actually seeing is these college-educated individuals are going back into these lower-wage, minimum-wage jobs. And these people don't deserve to be paid a pittance compared to a company's profits. It's just wrong.
And here's a tweet from Julie for you, Brian Mahoney, our labor reporter. Has the decline of the private labor union affected the fight for minimum wage increases?
I think there's definitely an argument to say yes. As union density has gone down over the past several decades in the United States, so have well-paying middle-class jobs. So certainly one might argue that there's not a causal relationship there, but unions typically are able to bargain more powerfully for higher wages in a workplace simply because workers in a union have more bargaining power.
Mike on the West Side. Hi, Mike. What are your thoughts?
Thank you for taking my call. Just real quick, back in the day when McDonald's first started opened up and all these fast food places were just up and running, it was grown men that worked back there, and they were paid a living wage. I mean, this wasn't a college kid or a high school kid job. These used to be real jobs until everything became automated. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Eric Altieri, is that part of your organization's argument?
You keep cutting out. What was his?
I'm sorry. If you couldn't hear his call, he said that back when McDonald's opened, the people that worked the line were grown men, and they were real jobs that paid a living wage.
To a degree, that was the case. A lot of these jobs, when we had a minimum wage that was more reflective of our worker productivity and more reflective of the value of our money in society, these were jobs that you could certainly survive on your own on, potentially if you're working full-time, take care of your children and not live below the poverty line. And now we have millions and millions of Americans that are working these jobs, and they have to work multiple minimum wage jobs, really just to make ends meet. And it's not good for the individuals, and more importantly, it's not good for the economy to have these suppressed wages, workers who have no spending power. And that's why we're really kind of seeing this growth go quite slowly in the economic recovery we're in.
So, Brian Mahoney, how do you see this issue shaping up through 2016?
I think wages in general are going to be a very big issue. Whether or not the rhetoric will be tied to raising the minimum wage, although that's certainly possible, I don't know. But inequality, raising the wage, increasing employment will continue to be major issues for both Republicans and the Democrats. Already you see Hillary Clinton speaking of raising the standards of everyday Americans, and I don't think we'll see dissimilar rhetoric from the right.
Well, we thank you both so much for joining us. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you
for having me.
We were joined by Brian Mahoney, labor reporter for Politico, and also on the line from Washington, Eric Altieri, director of communications with the Agenda Project and AP Action Fund. Their thoughts on the national movement to increase the minimum wage. Much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the draft and the Jags. But up next, how Dining Out for Life this month can help local patients living with HIV and AIDS. That's next.
Who will be Jacksonville's next sheriff? Ken Jefferson and Mike Williams emerged among seven hopefuls to replace term-limited John Rutherford. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present the Jacksonville Sheriff Debate. Listen to the Sheriff Debate, Tuesday, May 5th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM. Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at WJCT.org/relax.
Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Visit WJCT.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. Well, this Thursday night, just going out for a great meal can help save lives on the First Coast. We're talking about Dining Out for Life, benefiting the Northeast Florida AIDS Network. This is such a great tradition in our area, and it's easy to be part of it. Executive Director Donna Fuchs is here along with Derek Odom and Paige Kelton of Action News, the spokespersons. Hey, everybody. Good to see all of you.
Good morning,
Melissa.
Donna, you've got some real star power here with Derek and Paige, and we'll talk to them in a moment. But how long has Dining Out for Life been going on now in this area?
Melissa, believe it or not, this is our 10th year already.
That's amazing.
It is.
And it's grown every year, hasn't it?
Every year we have fantastic restaurants. This year we have some new ones, some new sponsors. We still have Biscotti's. You know, Biscotti's has been with us for all 10 years.
Wow. And so, Paige, Derek, Action News has really gotten behind Dining Out for Life. Why is that?
We have. We're all about, you know, people talk about, oh, it's only bad news out there. That is not true. We are about covering issues that are important to this community and the HIV and AIDS community here in Jacksonville. When you talk about Jacksonville being number three in the country, for that population in the services, the need for services has gone up and the money has gone down. So when you have an event like this where you partner with media, you partner with businesses and community groups, it's a win-win for everybody. And this is something I feel very passionate about. I know Derek does.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Action News always supports us in doing these kind of events. And, you know, we're part of this community, too. And we see this happening when we hear some of the statistics that Donna has told us about how high the infection rate is. I mean, it makes you want to do something. And this is an easy way to contribute to a great organization.
And it's fun. Just go have dinner.
And it's delicious.
Yeah. So tell us who's taking part this year.
Oh, this year we have Lola's and Carmine's are back at 50%. We have Derby on Park is back. Espeto, who has now moved out to the beach. Don't go over to their old location. They're now out at the beach. Roseanne is out there. She's supporting us again. We have two food trucks again. Baby's Badass Burgers and...
And I think we you just said that right on the radio, which is great.
it's their name.
I know, it's their name. But a whole long list is on your website, nfanjax.org.
Yes.
And people can look there. Now, tell us a little bit about the local AIDS Network and the work you do.
Well, Northeast Florida AIDS Network has been around since 1989, and we help those living with HIV and AIDS. We're a referral agency. We make sure that people get to their appointments, they get their medications, that they have food in their refrigerator, that their lights stay on, they stay in a good, safe home. And we're also there just for general support. Sometimes we're the only person that they can call to talk to when they're having a bad day because their family and friends don't know, because the stigma here in Jacksonville is just that bad still.
What are some of their greatest needs that you help meet?
Well, mostly housing at certain times. You're in electric in the winter. Food, getting the medications, getting the referral, mental health, substance abuse. People living with HIV have the same problems that everybody else has. And then when you start combining them, especially here in Jacksonville, the stigma just gets deeper and thicker.
And education, Melissa. I mean, we're still... you know, this many decades, you know, into this, still talking about education. educating people not only about the stigma of it, but educating people about how it's spread. A lot of, you know, pregnant women who are HIV positive just assume that they're going to pass it on to their child. That's not the case with early medical intervention. It's simple things that you would think people know about already, but they don't.
And hopefully events like this help raise that awareness. You know, like Paige said, you think, well, everybody has to know about this and how to protect themselves, but they don't. So education is so key.
Yeah, because Duval County has one of the highest HIV and AIDS rates in the state, doesn't it?
Yes, we do. We're fifth right now.
And what's driving that?
Well, lack of education. We don't have easy access to the public school system. We understand that they have an awful lot to teach children right now. So we encourage parents. It needs to start at home. Parents need to talk to their kids. They also need to talk to their parents. There is no age barrier when it comes to HIV.
Well, everybody's at risk. There is no face of HIV or AIDS anymore. You know, there was always this face people had in their minds of the people who this is who are impacted by this. It's men, women, children.
Comes from every community. Comes from all over. It's just not one place.
And have people sort of gotten away from focusing on this because they think, well, it's treatable now? Is that part of the problem?
Exactly. We were talking about that just a little while ago, how this generation that just grew up, they know people who take medication who become undetectable, so they don't focus on the prevention as much as they used to.
Donna, do you see that?
Right. And they do think it's just a treatable disease, but really you don't want to take medication every day for the rest of your life. There's still a lot of cost involved. And even though we're 30 years into this now, a lot of the very long-term effects of these medications are just now being realized.
Right. So with all of that said, this Thursday night, April 30th, you want to get everybody marking their calendar for Dining Out for Life and going out to a participating restaurant. How much of the till will go toward this cause?
The top two restaurants, 50% of their proceeds.
That's Carmine's and Lola's.
Carmine's and awesome. Lola's. And then it goes down from there for 25%, 35%. But for instance, Matthews is donating 25% of the proceeds. And there are four restaurants, right, Donna, that it includes alcohol sales.
That's correct.
And this is fun, too, because maybe they'll run into you guys. And lunch counts, too, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Lunch and dinner.
You can go to the website. It'll tell you what meals that they're donating during, where you can go, how you can make a reservation.
We also have information at actionnewsjax.com on Dining Out for Life.
Absolutely. I always try to do both. So I think I'm going to hit Lola's for lunch. That's 50%. You've got to go to one of those places, Lola's or Carmine's, for lunch or dinner.
Very nice. Derek Odom, Paige Kelton, Donna Fuchs. It's Dining Out for Life. Go to Action News' website or nfanjax.org to get the full list of restaurants. This is this Thursday, April 30th. Lunch and dinner count. All you have to do is do what you always do. Just pick a restaurant that's taking part in this. It's a great, great way to support the Northeast Florida AIDS Network. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you out there this Thursday.
Thanks,
Melissa. So
and we're back in a moment.
The Dinosaur Train is rolling into Orange Park. Thrasher Horn Center and WJCT present Jim Henson's Dinosaur Train Live, Buddy's Big Adventure, on Tuesday, May 12 at 6 p.m. See the beloved stars of the hit PBS series come to life on stage in your hometown for the first time. Join Buddy, Tiny, King, Don, and their family and friends in this fun-filled, interactive musical trip back in time. Tickets are on sale now at 904-276-6815 or thcenter.org.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Thank you.
The problem. Welcome back. Well, tomorrow night, Baptist Health, UNF, and Brooks are hosting a dinner with Natasha McEnroe. She's the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum in London. Second only to Queen Victoria herself, Florence Nightingale was the most famous woman in Victorian Britain. Although she's best remembered for her achievements during the Crimean War as the Lady with the Lamp, Nightingale's influence stretches far beyond that era. She dedicated her life to developing public health and pioneering sanitation. And Florence Nightingale actually hated her own celebrity. She lived the life of a recluse. But the volume and breadth of the correspondence Florence Nightingale produced over her life in both the public and private arena is immense, and it provides a fascinating record of her work on improving patient care, the training of nurses, and a wide range of other topics. Now, in her talk, Natasha McEnroe will explore how Florence's personal letters shed light on the world's best-known nurse. Take a listen.
Well, what I'm trying to do is to share with my new friends in Jacksonville is the project that we've been working on here at the Florence Nightingale Museum in London, which is quite an exciting international partnership. And what we're trying to do is to make available online all of Florence Nightingale's handwritten letters.
And that's A Woman of Words, Florence Nightingale's Life and Works Through Her Personal Correspondence. This talk is tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the UNF University Center, brought to you by Baptist Health, UNF, and Brooks. And this event is open to all interested caregivers, a really good opportunity, so get out and listen to Natasha McEnroe, the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum, flying over here from London to speak to people here. That's tomorrow night. And we'll be back in just a moment with Culpepper.
Who will be Jacksonville's next sheriff? Ken Jefferson and Mike Williams emerged among seven hopefuls to replace term-limited John Rutherford. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present the Jacksonville Sheriff Debate. Listen to the Sheriff Debate Tuesday, May 5th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the NFL draft starts Thursday. What will the Jaguars do? I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Culpepper's here now with a look at football and the rest of the week's sports. Hey there.
Hello. This is the week that if you're a college football fan, or you're an NFL fan, those two worlds collide.
Yeah.
Because, and if you're both, this is sort of like Christmas for football fans, because you get to unwrap a new player for your team, or several new players for your team, and the Jaguars certainly have a number of options with the third pick of the draft. More than anything, I think this year, they're going to be looking for a player who will make an immediate impact. In the past two drafts, the Jaguars had the luxury of building their team, laying down the foundation. And they drafted Luke Jokel a couple of years ago, then Blake Bortles last year. Both have played quite a bit and have been active in their rookie seasons, but neither has yet established themselves as a bona fide star. Now you say, well, it's only 1 year for Bortles, 2 years for Jokel. All true. But there is some building pressure on the current regime to start delivering in the win column. And I suspect that Dave Caldwell and company are going to be looking for a guy who can make the team better this year, not just a project, not just a guy who will eventually be a great player, but somebody who can help him this year as well. That guy could be Leonard Williams, a defensive tackle from USC. Not only does he figure to start right away, especially with Cedric Marks coming off knee surgery, but he's considered by a lot of draft analysts as the top-rated player in the draft.
Really?
So the Jaguars draft number three. And how do you get the top-rated player in the draft? Well, it's because quarterbacks always get overdrafted. Jameis Winston probably could go number one to the Buccaneers. Marcus Mariota, the other Heisman Trophy winner in this draft from Oregon, could go number two to Tennessee. And if that happens, the Jaguars then, in theory, would be able to draft the best player out there, which, if their board matches up the consensus, it would be Leonard Williams, the defensive tackle.
If the stars align. But what if not? Then who do they go for?
Well, okay, so let's say one of those quarterbacks will be gone before the Jaguars pick. Maybe the other one is still out there, and Williams goes number two maybe to Tennessee. Well, maybe that next option is to pick a Gator. Dante Fowler Jr. played linebacker and defensive end in Gainesville. Seems to be a perfect fit for Gus Bradley's defense as a Leo, a pass-rushing end, and you can never have too many pass rushers. That being said, rookies don't often come right in and make a huge difference rushing the passer. Usually those are skills that need to be developed. And so if you believe that, yes, they need to find somebody who can help them right now, then maybe you don't necessarily go after the pass rusher. But there are a lot of pass rushers in the top of the draft. Vic Beasley's another one. Shane Ray from Missouri. There are a number of different players who are pass rushers who could be out there and available.
Now, but, are you? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe they go on offense, though. You know, last year they drafted two wide receivers and then signed another one as an undrafted rookie who all played key roles, Allen Robinson, Marquise Lee, and Allen Hurns. But Amari Cooper from Alabama is a big star, and he figures to be the first wide receiver taken. Kevin White from West Virginia also figures to go in the top 10. So they may go in that direction. Now, they don't have any veteran leadership of the wide receiving core right now. So do you just take another rookie and have all these young guys running around?
That doesn't sound like a recipe for success.
You would say that, although, listen, if you think the guy's that good, if you think he is a number one, a true number one wide receiver, I think you think about taking him because you have to give Blake Bortles protection on the offensive line, which they have hoped to do through the free agency, signing a couple of guys who figure to start on the offensive line. Then you need to give him some weapons, and they signed Julius Thomas, the tight end from the Broncos in free agency. And so if you give him another wide receiver, another weapon, you figure he will be better this year. Now, the wild card player in this whole thing is Todd Gurley, the running back from Georgia. He had a knee injury. He was just looked like an absolute lock as a top 10 pick. And then he had a knee injury that ended his season and, as it turned out, his career at Georgia. But if he's healthy and he's ready to go, the Jaguars could really use a top running back because they just don't have that guy right now.
Well, the heat's on them, though, as you've been saying on this program. The leadership, they're going to have to turn some results this season.
I don't think it has to be a playoff season. I think it has to be a visible, clear, obvious step forward. So I'm putting the over-under on 5.5 for what they have to do in order to feel like that's a step forward. If they win six games, okay, that's better. They're heading in the right direction. Now, not all six-win seasons are created the same. Sometimes you get off to a great start, then collapse the rest of the season. People would have a different feeling than if you kind of mix in wins, a couple of here, a couple of there as the season goes on. But they do need to take a substantial step forward. And, of course, a big part of that is the quarterback taking a step forward, Blake Bortles, because in this day and age in the NFL, you just cannot win without having good quarterback play.
Moving on, the Armada back at home, and of course, you're one of the voices of the Armada. What's going on with our soccer team?
Back home for the next two Saturdays at Community First Park in the baseball grounds. They lost 3-2 in Tampa this past Saturday. Remember that the Armada drew over 16,000 at Everbank Field for the season opener. That was a North American League Soccer League record. And they're expecting to pack the house at Community First Park in the baseball grounds. Holds about 8,500 or so for soccer, so expecting sellouts or near sellouts the next 2 weeks for the Armada. This week they take on the defending NASL champion San Antonio Scorpions. And then next weekend it is Indy 11, the Indianapolis club. And it's kind of interesting to see in this first year how the rivalries start to develop. You know, already you've got Fort Lauderdale and Tampa who are in the league, and the Armada have played on the road at their place so far at each of those places and lost. So a little bit of a developing rivalry in the Sunshine State. But for Indy, Now you wonder if the Jaguars' Colts rivalry and the rivalry between the fans impacts how heated that rivalry yeah. will become.
Now, how do you see the Armada fan base kind of gelling here in our area?
Well, it's pretty impressive. Both for Fort Lauderdale and for Tampa, there were trips by supporters groups and Section 904, the big fan base, that went down there. And we had a shot on the TV broadcast on Saturday of I don't know, maybe 75 members of Section 904 all wearing their colors, waving the flags with the banners, the whole thing down in Tampa. So that group has been really dedicated to what's going on. They're very active on social media as well. And the, you know, the other key part of this is outreach to the soccer-playing community.
Sure, all the kids, who play parents soccer. And kids.
And I'll give you an example. Last Monday, the team took a practice on the road, went down to Davis Park in Nocatee for the Ponte Vedra Storm Youth Soccer Club, and there were a couple of hundred kids who got to watch the Armada practice, then meet the players, get autographs, take selfies afterwards, and you should have seen the number of smiling faces that came out of there, both with the kids and with the Armada players, by the way. So connecting with the community like that is really a big part of what the Armada is all about.
Two more teams to talk about, the Sharks and the Suns. The Sharks finally, by the way, tell me all about Elvis Night with the Sharks. All right,
so, of course, as you find in minor league baseball and the Arena Football League, you have these promotional nights, right?
Right.
So Elvis Night at the arena on this past Friday night, and it wasn't it fitting, and maybe not a coincidence, that it happens when the Las Vegas Outlaws come into town. So, you know, viva Las Vegas, and the Sharks really laid it on. Las Vegas 60-28 for their first victory of the season, and Sharks play their next two games on the road. I was not in attendance for Elvis Night.
I was going to say, were you dressed like in the comeback special gear, or was it Blue Hawaii Elvis? What would be your preference
well,
there?
Depending on the size of meal I have recently had, it may be Fat Elvis, you know, that I would have to go with just for authenticity's sake. But I think in general, I kind of like the Blue Hawaii theme anyway.
Sure. And last but not least, the Suns, 20-game homestand almost wrapped up.
Nearly done. Yesterday, they beat the Birmingham Barons to even their record at 8-8 on the season. Games tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday afternoon at the baseball grounds. And I do want to mention as well that the upcoming week has some interesting things going on in the world of sports, including Maurice Jones-Drew tomorrow will be retiring officially as a Jaguar. So that'll be his announcement that he'll be making tomorrow over at the stadium. That's going to be something to note. And the other one's kind of an interesting story out of JU. There is a 17-year Navy veteran by the name of Brian Holcomb who's going to start as the pitcher for JU on Tuesday when they play Georgia Southern.
How exciting.
So this will be kind of an opportunity for him to get a moment to go out there and play. And he's only slated to pitch to one batter, but you know, who knows? He does great. He was a terrific high school pitcher back in his day, but here's a guy who has served in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and others, and he's at JU now and going to get a chance to live
Good
a little bit of a childhood
excellent.
Dream. Yeah,
that's excellent. Well, always great to have you on the show. He's Culpepper. Follow him at Culpepper on Twitter for all of this area's sports. Have a great week. See you soon.
Thanks very much.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. We want your feedback. Just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Our daily podcast is now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, more than 2,500 people have lost their lives in the magnitude 7.8 earthquake that hit Nepal Saturday. The latest from Kathmandu and new questions about preparing for and predicting seismic activity. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.